Right.
Mel, good morning. How have you been?
Yeah, not too bad. All things considered.
That's great. I think you survived another batch of Kibbediana, didn't you?
Yeah, not seriously so. Just normal routine stuff.
Very relieved to
And
hear it.
didn't get in the way of anything.
That's the
So
most
yeah,
important
no, I
thing,
can't
isn't
complain.
it? Yeah. So I'm wondering what the mood is on the doorstep this week around Reeves's budget, and of course your reactions to it. Graham's just joining us in a moment.
Yes, I've not had time to. I've only been out a couple of times since. And I'd say it's very rare that these big national issues actually come up on the doorstep. Not very rare. It does happen. People ask me my views of things, but mostly when I'm going around, it is about the local issues. It's this week I've had a couple of days on one of our big housing estates, and people are far more interested in mould in their own bathrooms or bedrooms than they are about budgets, I think, quite understandably. So I don't know that I've picked up a feeling as yet as to what folk in West Hill think about the budget. It'll be interesting if they do raise it with me. And they recognise as well, I think they know I'm independent, so I don't have strongly expressed views on a lot of these things. I do, obviously, on the odd thing. Actually, funny enough, when Leonie arrives, there was what I thought was quite an amusing exchange at the council meeting last week, where Leonie accused the Conservatives of all acting like me and not having any. Ah, here's Leonie. Hi. Just wait for her to join, and I'll raise it.
Hello.
Hi, Leonie.
Good
I was just
morning,
talking about
Leonie. How are you? And well, good morning,
the
Graham.
council meeting. The council meeting last week, where you accused the Conservatives of acting like me and not being political. Which I took slight exception to. Just because I'm independent doesn't mean I can't be political. I'm not party political. I'm not sort of party pre, but I think I'm actually quite political on quite a lot of issues.
I think you misinterpreted what I said,
I
but
know, I know. It was actually an attempt to. It was getting quite fractious, and it was my perhaps misjudged attempt to introduce a slight degree of levity into matters.
likewise, that was why I said
Yeah,
it.
quite. Yes, yeah. Because
You
it
know
was
the
getting a bit
psychology
hard
of these
work.
people. It must be an odd situation where over years of party lines attrition, you actually know these people as people. And it's not a question of pressing their buttons. It's just knowing their foibles and fallibilities, and those are the situations they inhabit, I guess.
It's not even so much that as and the councillor who was speaking isn't necessarily one that I know terribly well. There's a sort of an element of there can be an element of unpleasantness sometimes in the council meetings, which makes the whole evening not a very nice experience. If people really start needling each other, and personally, I prefer it if there is an it's nice. You can be very political, but you don't actually have to be, spend the entire evening being absolutely vile, as well.
Yeah, because it can go to extremes, can't it? And so often you see administrations beating themselves up. I mean, the forming coalition of UKIP, I think, was legendary for that in the London Assembly, wasn't
I'm sorry, I missed that.
it? Yeah, I'll come a bit closer to the mic. I'm thinking of your tales of UKIP beating itself up in the London Assembly and their brief flurry there. It is a thing, and it doesn't play well optically, does it? It usually heralds some sort of demise or retrenchment.
I don't think it does come across particularly well if people are very sort of sulky or moody or just downright rude to each other. No, I don't.
And at the local level, I had a quick gander actually for the very first time at one of Malcolm's old stamping grounds, Conservative Home, and somebody, a scrutinesque teacher, philosopher, talking about Robert Jenrick, the local politician, which for me was a bit of a stretch, but clearly he knows whereof he speaks. And it seemed to me that in the midst of the national brouhaha and the concerns about both candidates, that somebody is tapping into something, at least making an attempt at doing so, that strikes a human note.
Well, I think the real problem Robert Jenrick versus Kemi Badenoch, and obviously we'll get the result of that later today. No, sorry, tomorrow. Is how many conservatives of my acquaintance have all told me that they've spoilt their ballot paper or they just haven't returned it because they
None of the
feel that,
above.
yeah, they don't want either of them. And actually, I think James Cleverly is much to blame here because it looks as though his team were trying to be too clever by half and ended up with him dropping out. And at least that there would have been people with slightly different viewpoints if it had been him versus one of the other two. With Badenoch versus Jenrick, it's Hobson's choice, isn't it?
It's what we've seen. We've talked about this before of what I think happens to parties when they lose power after a long period of hegemony. So in 79, when Labour had been in control for 11 of the previous 15 years, and they lost to Thatcher, they sort of muddled off into their left wing comfort zone by electing Michael Foot as leader after the 1990 election when sorry, 1987 when Tony Blair came in, the Tories edged off towards William Hague and Ian Duncan Smith, who were both very much on the right of the party at that stage. You know, Hague, I think, flourished into a very, very fine statesman, but at that stage he was really, you know, just a kind of standard bearer for the right. And then the same with Labour after 2010 with Miliband and Corbyn. And it looks like the Tories are doing that now, of going back to their sort of right-wing roots for a while. And then after a bit of time, the parties decide they quite like another crack at power. So Labour elected Neil Kinnock, who I have massive respect for what he did to take on the left of the Labour Party and make Labour electable again. Michael Howard did a similar role for the Tories in the mid 90s, and that I think was Starmer's job there. And then you get a charismatic, directed leader who actually, you know, cashes in on that and gets elected, like Tony Blair and David Cameron did. And I hoped that the Tories wouldn't make the same mistake again. I hoped they'd get back to being a serious opposition. But it was the same arguments in 97 when Michael Portillo's campaign, sorry, 2001, when Michael Portillo's campaign messed up and ended up with him not being on the ballot for leader. The party ended up with Ian Duncan Smith. It's supposed to be the most sophisticated electorate in the world, the Parliamentary Conservative Party, but they do seem to make some pretty fundamental mistakes.
I can't quite get a handle on how this happened. Perhaps we can come back to it a bit.
Well,
Graham, good morning and welcome back.
Andy, it's very simple. The
Okay.
first rule of counting, first rule of politics is you must be able to count, and
No.
someone in the cleverly camp clearly couldn't. Hello, Graham.
Hi, good morning.
Well, clearly remedial maths required, but I wonder if some people are suggesting that's the case, well, as they do with most budgets. You know, there are always cries of economic illiteracy and dubious relevance and whatnot. What were your first reactions, Graham, to Rachel Reeves?
Well, that she was actually putting forward a Labour budget, and fulfilling the promises. I think she did it rather well by leaking, a lot of it beforehand, so people ready for it. But no, I think she's obviously, you can't predict what's going to happen. I mean, there's lots of people who have tried to predict what's going to be the effect, but it's extremely difficult to do that, to forecast the effect as to whether it's going to increase growth or not.
Yeah,
But
there's the
it's
curious role in all this of the Office for Budget Responsibility, which seems to have been sort of sidelined by Hunt, or so such is the claim, and consequently they can't verify this mysterious black hole that Labour referred to in the run-up to the election, indeed yesterday.
Yeah, she's refused. They're refusing to verify there is one, but
That's not quite true. They have definitely verified 10 billion. I think where they are not completely in accord with the government is 22 billion. It's the size of the hole that they are agreeing that there were completely unfunded spending commitments that the government had made in this year. And it's not even in future years, it's in this year that the government just knew it was going to have to spend. So, for example, they hadn't budgeted for hotels for migrants. One of my favorite programs is on radio is More or Less with Tim Harford, and it's all sort of statistics and
Statistician.
numbers. Yes, it's all statistics and numbers. And so they looked at the 22 billion black hole and to say whether or not, is this a made up number? And a lot of it is made up with this figure of, oh, we didn't add anything in for the cost of putting up migrants in hotels. Well,
Pretty large cost.
that's clearly nonsense. And then there were a couple of other things that they just had not budgeted. I mean, they said they were going to spend money on them, but they hadn't budgeted for them. And one was, I believe, the amount of money that they had said, we are going to compensate people because of the infected blood scandal. And that's quite a lot of money. And then I think they also hadn't set any money actually aside for compensating the people who were treated so badly by the post office, the postmasters and
Both
postmistresses.
highlighted in Reeves's budget.
Just those three alone comes to almost the 22 billion, I believe. Just those three items that I can just say straight off the top of my head. And there are some other things that they had said they were going to spend money on and then just hadn't put into their departmental spending budgets.
I think there was some comment, it was in the FT, that said, well, there was an assumption that ministers would make savings to comply with the, the necessary due diligence and to square everything off. But that presumably would be a sort of a sequence of lobby conversations or whatever, and gentle person's agreements, but nothing actually set in stone as a policy, as a directive, as in fact leadership. I'm just thinking hypothetically, were Badenoch or Jenrick to be in power as of this time next week, what would happen to those spending commitments? Would you like to speculate?
Not on a hypothetical like it's irrelevant, I think, because they're not going to be there for another 5 years.
Well, the reason, I guess really what I'm thinking is that there might be a sort of a, given the fact that there's this lack of communication between previous and succeeding administration and the body they both sign up to, then there's the World Economic Forum in the background sort of giving this the rubber stamp, that people will psychologically will have what's happened recently in their minds, and also the recent Tory by-election wins that Mal highlighted when we were back around before, suggesting that aspects of what went before still have some appeal to people, and the suggestion that well, financial and other kinds of competence sort of resides at a variety of places.
Yeah, I think they're relying on people not taking the budget in good faith, and making the usual extreme criticisms or misinterpreting to give the idea
Being
of
disingenuous about
constantly
it, you would say.
this is great. Well, yeah, breaking promises, that kind of thing. Concentrating on, I mean, the main thing I think is that it's actually coherent with the labor policies, the employment bill that's going through, and workers' rights and that sort of thing. It's coherent with that, and it's shifting the distribution of income to the poor, which is what labor is supposed to be doing. And obviously you get the squeals from the better off. But I think most people will realize that that's what she's doing, and give her the benefit of the doubt, because it's impossible to predict, because it depends on whether the investors come in or not, as to whether we get growth.
Well, Reeves has sort of said this is a budget she doesn't want to have to repeat. So there's quite a lot of infrastructure spend. HS2 revived, a lot of money going to the major municipalities. I'd like to talk about the potential impact of London of all this in a moment. But tax rises. A lot of people suggesting that this is going to hit people who find themselves, however improbably in the current climate, on the up a little bit.
Yeah, it's very difficult to do it. It's a very blunt tool, you know, passing financial acts. So you always some people always miss out. Apparently, the farmers are missing out on the inheritance.
There's another one, inheritance tax. Yeah.
But that could be. I mean, it all indicates that it is very long term planning. You know, they may be targeting land ownership in the country. So I think it's quite an impressive budget, actually. if what she says is true, that they have come in and found this gigantic black hole, and then have made a budget as they have.
Yeah. Very helpful of Leonie to fill in what these items appear to be. Big political hot potatoes that were mysteriously unaccounted for. Mal, what are your overall impressions of how Reeves has done this time?
It's that's always interesting to see how the markets have responded. We've seen gilt yields increase by about a quarter of a percent. By about a quarter of a percent, which is from about, you know, four and a bit up to just short of 4.5, which suggests that people think that the government is going to run into some sort of financial challenges, difficulties, maybe too big a statement from that. But on the other hand, you know, international markets quite often change their minds a week after their initial response as they digest the news. So I'm not sure that of itself is a cause for enormous panic. I think it's really interesting to analyse to work out why Labour has just so unpopular just 3 months after an enormous election victory. You mentioned the by-elections. It is now a fairly established pattern over the last few weeks that Labour are losing about half of the seats that they are defending, and not picking up any extra ones. So yesterday in Wolverhampton, they lost a seat to Reform. Last week, they lost 3 seats straight to the Conservatives when they were defending 6 seats and lost 3 of them. And I think two of the facts in there. One is, I think, a sense that a disappointment that with all the news of the freebies that the Labour front bench have been taking over many years, and you know, indulging in the same sort of behaviour that they were slamming the Tories for. We've seen this week a Labour MP apparently, you know, quite brutally beating a constituent, and Labour front benchers coming out and saying, "Oh, he's really quite a nice chap. You shouldn't. This isn't typical, and we shouldn't judge on this." Which I suspect is not the stance they'd have taken if this was a conservative who had behaved in that sort of way. So I think, you know, they had a chance when they come in to really draw a line under the particularly we're talking about the Johnson years in terms of the misbehaviour of the Tories, although it went deeper than that, but it was really, I think, came back to Boris Johnson. And they fluffed that opportunity. They came out as looking as being just as self-interested, or some of them being just as self-interested as some of the Tories were. And I think the other thing is just how we should remember in May, Keir Starmer was in the Commons challenging Rishi Sunak. He said there's a £46 billion hole in the public finances. But given that, can he guarantee that he won't reduce the winter fuel allowance, and won't remove the winter fuel allowance. 3 months, this was only in May. You know, a very short number of months later, we're being told there's this unexpected 22 billion hole in the public finances, which is less than half the size he was telling us the hole was just in May, and implementing the very policies that he's just been implying that the Tories are so nasty that they would do this. And I think that, and the cap on the bus fares, which for rural and the less well off, it doesn't affect happen in London, and Andy Burnham in Manchester has said that he will continue to cap fares there. But elsewhere in the country, and particularly in rural areas where people depend so much on the bus, this could well be the difference between a pensioner getting out into the local town once a week to visit the bank or to do the shopping, or just to interact with other people. And they look, and I know the Tories haven't put money in the budget for the bus cap, and fair enough, but the things that have been chosen against giving a huge pay rise to tube drivers who are on £60,000 a year, there's just a kind of sense in there that this doesn't look like what Labour governments do. It doesn't look like they penalise pensioners who are struggling and put bus fares up enormously, put bus fares up by 50% in rural areas. So I don't know. I suspect those sorts of considerations are why the gloss came off Labour extraordinarily quickly, more quickly, I think, than any other change of control I can remember in my lifetime. Now, the budget has, it's in some senses quite positive, but many of the, if growth is the big issue for the economy, I'm not sure that in some of it, its responses, this was particularly a budget for growth. What I think is good is a focus on investing in infrastructure, which is never very sexy in politics, but is vital to future of economy. So I think there are some clear positives there. But whether it's enough to put them back into a good odour with the public, I guess we'll need to see. I'm a bit doubtful.
Sort of inside the tent, Leonie, how do you react to that analysis?
I mean, I think, the inheritance wasn't good at all. I'm thinking previous podcasts that Malcolm has always argued that the Conservatives run the economy well and until people get fed up with them, and then Labour comes in and delivers on all the good things that we want until people get fed up with that, and then they bring the Conservatives back in. I mean, in one sense, I think it is a completely classic Labour budget that includes, a big hike in spend and a big hike in borrowing and a big hike in taxation, even if they haven't gone ahead with the increases in VAT, personal national insurance or tax. I mean, I think the biggest increase is the national insurance changes, with the dropping of the threshold where national insurance payments kick in, dropping that from 9,000 down to 5,000. And then also include increasing the rates of employers' national insurance. So, I mean, that is going to make quite a big difference. I've been talking to people. I'm a Wandsworth Oasis trustee, and we employ, I don't know, let's say 50 staff, because that's a round number. That is actually almost exactly the number of staff that we. So we're well above the. We're going to help small micro businesses. I think they've said there'll be some help available for businesses that employ up to 4 staff. So 40 or 50 staff is way over that. It's going to be a big increase in what we're paying over to the government from the employer's national insurance. Someone else I know works for a much bigger company, 3,000 employees, and the increase in their national insurance bill is going to be about £3 million. So, I mean, there'll be quite a hike in the National Insurance Bill for the Greater London Authority, of which the Assembly is part. So these are big numbers. These are really big numbers that companies are going to have to find. So I think that's my jury is out on the what impact that might have in terms of growth, because I think that's what a number of companies who've been commenting on the budget have been saying. Well, it's going to be hard for us to invest for growth in our business if we're having to give over, an extra 3, 4, 5 million pounds to the government, in terms of national insurance payments. On the bus fare cap that Malcolm mentions, I mean, it's a cap. It doesn't apply in London. Fares in London won't change. They're at 175 per fare. They will remain at 175 for a single fare. The hopper fare remains in place. So if you change buses within an hour of your first bus, you pay
Somewhat later,
175.
yeah.
175 for both buses, not just one. Or nothing changes in London at all. But the cap outside of London was due to expire. So the cap has now been increased from £2 to £3, but it's a cap. So it's up to the bus companies themselves whether they want to leave the fares at £2 or move them up to £2.50 or move them to £3. They may not need to. I can understand why they've increased the cap from, it's been £2 for quite some time. Because the two biggest costs for these privatised bus companies, and there is a big discussion as to whether or not privatising buses was ever a sensible thing, but that's a separate issue. They are privatised at the moment. And the two biggest costs are staffing costs, which, as I've just mentioned, are definitely going up because of changes to employer national insurance, and of course, fuel. So I can see why you would allow companies the option to perhaps increase their fares from a maximum of £2 to a maximum of three. But obviously, you are more likely to lose customers, I suppose, if you don't keep the fares down. And it's that balance, isn't it, which we've tried to strike in London, so that you have a mass transit, mass use system, and the money comes in from the vast number of people using it rather than from individually higher fares. And that's each bus company will have to make its own decision about where it sits on that particular continuum. I think there is an issue about the loss of the by-elections, and I'm not sure that it's being looked at enough yet by any of the parties. I think the Conservatives are distracted by their leadership contest. I think Labour at the moment is still a bit distracted by having won the election in such style. The by-elections are not parliamentary by-elections, they're by-elections in councils. I think any by-election loss is not a good thing. And it's something I think the party's going to have to get to grips with, if it can, as soon as possible.
I think it's the, I mean, that's clearly right. I think, though, the contrast with what's happened after previous general elections is interesting. That in previous cases, there has been a period where people, and yeah, there may be a psychological thing wanting to be associated with the winners nationally, but the party that has just come into power tends to do really rather well in by-elections for a varying period of time. With Labour under Blair, it was a very long time where they were still winning by-elections after they took national power. And so there is a contrast there. And in every case, I mean, that is, for example, in Eccles in Salford, where Labour held on to a seat, the turnout was just over 16%. And it's entirely fair to say that the turnouts in by-elections are tiny, generally speaking, so you've got to be very, very careful about reading too much into them. But this is a very, very consistent trend now across very, very different types of of councils. Last week, Labour was losing seats in places like South Ribble in Lancashire. It lost a seat in Monmouthshire in Wales. It's been losing seats in London. We saw in Wandsworth, and sorry, that was before the general election. But it's been losing. So it lost a seat to the Greens in Hackney a couple of weeks ago. It's losing seats in Woke, Worthing. It lost a seat to the Tories recently. So, right the way across the country, very, very different types of seats. The Labour vote seems to drop by a fairly consistent 20%. And the swing to whoever the main challenger is perceived to be tends to be of the order of 15 to 20%. And so that's, this is entirely recoverable. There's 5 years to another general election. So panic buttons should not be pressed on the basis of this, but neither, I think, should it be entirely discounted as being just about local factors. People don't just vote locally in local elections, and we see that, in fact, just the opposite, that generally speaking, people in local elections vote on national trends, and the national swing towards one party or another is just as visible in local election results as it is in national election results. So something that I think is just interesting that it's happened this quickly, and something for Labour to keep a serious eye on. But I do agree with Leonie, this is not an indication of what's going to happen in the next election.
Graham, do you think there's a disconnect between the pragmatism and the potential you see in Reeves's budget and the optics around at the moment? I mean, Mal mentioned earlier on the payola business of Starmer's suits and what have you. But beyond all that, there is a sense of discontent in the country that Labour hope to capitalise on. What could they do to make it perhaps around the budget, perhaps around other things, to make, I suppose, the message a bit more coherent?
Well, I think they factored the unpopularity in. I mean, they have said that they have to make the hard choices at the beginning, which is they lose their popularity. They're expecting that because they'll recover by the next election. So I don't think there's that much to be read in by the unpopularity increasing. It's also very much to do with the sophisticated tactics of the right wing to put them in a bad light. So I think it's more significant is the long-term policy shift, and they have put distance between themselves and the conservatives, which is far more significant. They've re returned to Keynesian economics, which is far more significant than local disgruntled voters, I think.
And they will
And
always be grumbling, I suppose, won't they?
well, I think the way it works is that, they set the policy and they indicate the shift, and then they've got the localized policies to sort out the inconsistencies and unfairnesses at a local level, and all the department's implementation of the policy is where it's going to be adjusted, for fairness and towards the overall aim of shifting income to the poorer. I think that this is I'm reading a very interesting book by Peter Turchin. I don't know whether you've read it.
Not come
But
across the ground. Tell us more.
he's invented a new field of study called cleodynamics, with a cleo from the muse of history, and dynamics is the movement of history. And he's got a database collecting big data in a think tank in Austria. And he's collected big data from every civilization, from the lower Nile to the upper Manhattan, as he says. And he's pointing out the consistencies about when civilizations fail. which all civilizations have failed, obviously. So, and the most recent one being, or the current one being, America. It fits into this pattern. And the pattern is a very simple pattern that we all recognize, is that it happens when you get the inequality, extreme inequalities. And people actually notice that their wages are stagnant while the rich income is increasing. And they notice the local wage stagnation far more than they do about the increase in rich of the wealthy. So that goes with the local perception of their own condition rather than the national condition, or the condition of the whole civilization. But the interesting thing that is new, I think, in his predictions is that he notices that there's a trend when the elites who are in power, whether they're political or economic or cultural, it's when the elites get, there's not enough positions of power for the elites to fill. There's more elites than the positions to fill. And so the unsuccessful elites form a separate body and then start attacking. So you get this the battle between the elites, and that seems to be happening in America at the moment.
Farageist, I suppose you might say.
They're splitting off. They can't get power, so they want power. They want to get power some other way, which explains the far right shift in Europe as well.
And in Austria, and of course, scholarly, I suppose, they're sort of in now, aren't they? But it's good to know that this kind of independent research is a thing. Sort of raises perhaps a wider point as to whether how much historical research and the sort of zeitgeist figures in political research in general, and whether it ought to.
Well, it does explain why there's this extraordinary support for Trump. And he says that it's not, Trump's more or less incidental. He's just recognized this person intuitively, and he's just riding the wave of this discontent between the... I mean, he points out how the salaries, like in America and the UK at the moment, the salaries during the Civil War, for instance, within 50 years before the Civil War, salaries stopped going up for the poor, whereas the rich, the new industries, increased. There's huge inequality, not
and
just
this is how social change brews, really, isn't it? I guess over certainly 50 years in those days, I suppose, would have been the nature of communications. Would have been not that long a time, but these days, I suppose, even less so.
To finish that does with Rachel Reeves' shift in her budget, with this shift to recognizing that the poor are very unhappy at being poor, and they have expectations of being far at least as wealthy as their parents. So she's shifting the income, which the book points out that the way the civilizations have a soft or a hard landing is what actions they take, obviously what policies they try to reverse the decline.
Reeves actually said in her opening spiel, I think, that she wanted to make people feel, and with a sort of Blairite echo here, more affluent than perhaps they actually are. I'm not suggesting this is any kind of sleight of hand. It's just a sort of feel-good factor. Whereas, and I'm making a huge generalization here, certainly in Trumpian terms in America, the whole thing seems to be fueled by a sort of righteous, zealous anger. But how are they doing over there? I mean, it seems the outcome at the moment via those seven swing states seems to be wafer thin. You've also got the Jill Stein factor in the middle, splitting the vote. Leone, would you like to weigh in on that? But do you think Harris can pull through?
I think anybody who tells you they know what the outcome of the election in America is going to be is lying. It's too close to call. The margin of error on most of the opinion polls is plus or minus 3%, and the poll of polls where they add the polls together in the seven swing states are showing that the difference between the two candidates is a plus one or plus 2%. So it's within the margin of error. So it is literally going to come down to who can get out the most supporters in various precincts across those seven states. The other states in the union, I think it's a sort of foregone conclusion where they're going to go. Whoever wins Pennsylvania, which is the one that's got the largest number of electoral college votes at 19, so running in advance of Arizona, which I think is on 11 or 12, and the others, you know, which are less. But whoever wins in Pennsylvania will probably be the one that takes the White House. And at the moment, the difference between them has been Harris has been sort of 1 point or 2 points ahead of Trump, or Trump has been 1 or 2 points ahead of Harris, and it's sort of moved backwards and forwards. It's just very, very tight.
It's interesting how local in Arizona this week and other areas and other times all of this ends up being, doesn't it? The country's so vast.
It's massive. I mean, whether or not having a comedian who declared Puerto Rico to be an island of floating garbage is going to help Trump's campaign is
any quotes, I think. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yes, obviously an absolutely hilarious joke that we all laughed ourselves silly over. Not. I don't know whether that's going to put a hole in his campaign. Apparently there are groups of voters who he has somehow been appealing to. I mean, I think the problem is outside of America, almost nobody understands the appeal of Trump. I absolutely do not at all. I find him about as appealing as, I mean, I just can't even compare him to anything. He's just so awful. And he's just, the thing that I've seen this week is pictures of him with Jeffrey Epstein. And accounts of young women coming over to New York for a beauty pageant that he was arranging. And then, you know, either he was passing them on to Epstein or taking them upstairs in Trump Tower to his boardroom and then jumping on them himself. I mean, it's just any other politician, all of these things would be death. Absolutely.
I think
death.
Trump was saying he was going to protect women against, well, Puerto Ricans, amongst others, whether they liked it or not. I suppose this would be the manner in which he would presumably do it.
Well, yes, he'd literally thrust his own body between
the sword and banner. Yeah,
I mean, he is just so sordid; it is unreal. The number of court cases is unreal, and yet somehow he's managed to turn everything round into little me. I'm being attacked. I hope that Harris can do it, but I don't know if she can.
Yeah. What is your, well, I won't say crystal ball, Mal, but your vast accretion of wisdom suggests might happen?
Well, mine is as cloudy as Leone's. I've absolutely no idea what the outcome is going to be. I just continue to despair that the one of the leading countries in the world, the one of the biggest democracies in the world, can't come up with a candidate that I would feel any sort of enthusiasm about voting for. Trump is ghastly. Harris seems to me to just not understand the whole string of really basic issues. And
tell us more about that lack of understanding.
It's interesting how she's refused to do very many interviews with this. Now, normally that's a sign that you're so confident you're going to win that you don't want to risk making a gaffe. And I guess Boris Johnson was a classic example of that in 2019, of not taking part in the leadership debates and so on, because he thought he was going to win, and there was no need to risk that. It's an interesting strategy, though, when things are this tight, And they, what was the one? A couple of examples will come back into mind while we're talking, where just in fairly basic bits of world politics and so on, she's just clearly showing that she hasn't got that big a grasp of the issues. And it's actually quite a long time. I was trying to think back when there was, I think John McCain was an extremely honourable man. I think Barack Obama clearly was. So you know, America shows that they can come up with candidates who are, you know, I mean, Obama has just got such grace and such humanity. If I were, you know, quite independent of the politics, but if I were an American, I'd be very comfortable at Barack Obama representing me on the world stage, as I would with John McCain, who I think was an extremely honourable man who stood against Obama in the in Obama's second
Sarah Palin.
election. But well, yeah, I mean, yes, okay, fair point. He did
Anyway.
have Sarah Palin as his presidential running mate, which was a, I'm sure, was an attempt at a political calculation. I'm not sure it was all that successful. It
That'd be
was
amazing.
one of those elections where Obama was so clearly going to get a landslide that that struck us. Me as being a bit of desperation and a misstep, but McCain himself, I think, was an enormously honourable man.
He
But
spoke
yeah,
out against
Hillary
his own
Clinton,
party and certainly against Trump. Yes,
well, indeed, yes, and Trump was, you know, and said very clearly he didn't want Trump at his funeral, and Trump was just awful towards him, as saying, you know, mocking his war record where he you know been tortured as a prisoner of war. You know, can't imagine what would happen to Trump in the same circumstance. But so America has shown over the years that it can produce people of real stature, but somehow it's lost the art and it's gone into things. And I know the yeah that the Biden the way that Biden chose to stand down didn't leave an awful lot of time for them to have a proper plow through the next generation of Democrat hopefuls. But I have to say, you know the old trick of if you're not sure what you think about something, you've got a decision to make, you toss a coin, and if the coin comes down and you're a bit disappointed, that helps you to know what your real thinking is. And if it comes down and you think you're quite relieved it's come down that way, then that means that's where you were thinking. And I've tried this just two or three times in the, you know, the privacy of my own home, doing this with the American election. So heads for Trump's tail for Harris. And every single time it's come down, I've been disappointed. It's just horrendously uninspiring.
That's such an eloquent pairing of words there. Is there something psychologically, Graham, in America at the moment that is, as it were, bringing on the end of its civilization by deifying Trump?
Yeah, absolutely. It does fit with this analysis of
A clear knowledge,
decline
yeah.
of civilizations. Yeah, because the reason people follow him is because they have given up on politicians as a whole. I mean, the phrase is, "Oh, they're all the same." I don't know which one to vote for. I'm going to vote for neither. And that is exactly that
Lucky
they're not.
outsider, yeah.
They're not analyzing, certainly, or even thinking about what the effect of the either one is going to have, and so it fits with this idea that there's a super production of elites and there's just too many people. I mean, there were far more candidates for the presidency than before, and so that's the sort of indication there's a lot of people wanting to stand. And the number of billionaires in America has gone up staggeringly. All these figures are in the book, about how the wealth has separated while the wages have remained stagnant. That dissociates why they're voting for him. They don't care what he says, and they often say, "It doesn't matter what he does, I'm going to vote for him because
Stand
it's
down
the only
to
one."
President. Let's shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue, and I'd still be elated.
Yeah, and that's because it's against the whole political system that they're, and this is fits in with this separation of the elites. So the power structure is split, which it has with the Republican. And I mean, before they had to cooperate in making policies, but now they simply refuse. If it's the opposite, they don't agree. So they're fighting each other, in other words, rather than debating what best to do for the country. They're not acting in the interest of the country. They're acting in the interest of their party.
Sort of resistance to their own culture in some way. Leone, the report... Sorry, Graham, do go ahead.
I was going to say that also happened in the UK. You know, conservatives just acting for their own party, and Farage acting for his own, rather than acting for the whole country when they get elected.
Just a glance at this a conservative at home suggests that there's some attempt to establish some sort of intellectual canon behind what might be coming up, which has, I think, been distinctly lacking in recent months. It's as you say, it's had a distinct Trumpian edge to it, hasn't it? Certainly through Farage, not a Tory, but I think would become one.
There's a huge relief of the return to normal politics in with the Labour Party. You know, and there's almost a reassurance with all the same old stuff and the disadvantages, you know, but it's still something that you recognise, that they're doing their basic job of trying to save the country rather than
disgruntled civility and the constitution in that sense. And
what understanding does Trump have of the constitution? He doesn't even know what it is, probably.
No.
He doesn't understand the concept of the rule of law either. I mean, it's a really fundamental split in the power structure in America, and it's the nature of populism. The popular understanding of politics isn't that deep either.
I suppose there's not then going to be the reverse effect of America sneezing and us catching cold. It doesn't work the other way. Report by Andrew Rawnsley in The Observer, I think, Leone, that Starmer's had a private lunch with Trump recently in Trump Tower. He had a flying visit over there, presumably to thrash out what might happen if Trump wins. Would you speculate on how Starmer might feel this debacle?
I mean, of course he had to speak to Trump. I think it took place when he went out for the recent, I can't remember whether it was either the G7 or the United Nations meeting, which he dashed off to. He's done a couple of trips across the Atlantic, and I think he's met all three of them, as in Biden, Kamala Harris.
Sent some volunteers over to
Harris. I think the person who's probably been, they've tried to embarrass the most about Trump has been David Lammy, who had made some fairly pungent statements about Trump. And obviously he's now our representative on the world stage, because he's the foreign secretary. But by all accounts, the lunch between Starmer and Trump, which I think took place in Trump Tower, seems to have gone well, whatever that means. I think it means that Donald Trump didn't come out saying that he thought Starmer was an idiot or words to that effect. I mean, I can hardly think of two people more different. Starmer's background before he came into politics was imposing the law. Trump's background before he came into politics seemed to have been breaking the law. Starmer, you know, clearly, I don't think by any stretch could be described as a sort of populist demagogue. Trump is nothing but a populist demagogue. Very, very different characters, very, very different way of presenting themselves, very, very different background. But we shall see. We get these alliances that form between world leaders of a very different temperament and very different politics. Starmer's also been in Italy and seems to have struck up quite an understanding with Giorgio Meloni, and
of course, yeah.
You could hardly say his politics and Giorgio Meloni's politics are similar at all. She's another interesting case of someone who got elected, and actually been around for quite some while, and then the Fratelli d'Italia, the Brothers of Italy, sort of broke through and are now very much the largest party in Italy. She broke through and then tacked to the centre, it would seem, with quite a lot of her policies.
Yes, I was just thinking that. You put it rather better than I was going to. Yeah.
So the point that Malcolm was making about people sort of stomping off into their sort of happy hunting ground of the left wing or the right wing, if they do manage to win, they sort of normally apparently seem to tow the party back to the centre. Maybe Viktor Orban is the proof that that doesn't always happen, because he seems to be marching ever further rightward. And in fact, I think his foreign secretary is currently in Russia, saying lovely things to Putin, which is quite offensive to most people, really. So, no, I think you can find these strange alliances between leaders. I would rather not think that there's going to be any more strange alliances with Putin, but he certainly seems to have done some sort of deal with the lovely Kim from North Korea. If accounts are to be believed, it sounds as though many thousands of North Koreans are about to enter the war in Ukraine, which I don't think will be very helpful as far as the Ukrainians are concerned, because I think they were very much on the back foot in terms of numbers. But, you know, that's follows on from Donald Trump trying to be rather friendly with the North Korean leader as well. So you do see these strange bedfellows springing up occasionally on the international stage. I would hope that if Trump does win, that some of the more ridiculous statements that have been emanating from them, that China's important but Russia isn't. If you cannot see the link between China, North Korea and Russia, you are not looking. You know, the
or looking away, so I think,
You know, the red carpet has been firmly rolled out when Vladimir Putin turned up in China. He's been to North Korea. You know, these links are there between those three countries. I don't want to say that this is becoming our modern day version of an axis of evil, because I think that's language I don't care to use myself, but I find that the idea of those three countries getting together very, very worrying. And it's also been noticeable that other countries are flirting. I don't really want to go any further than that, but they're certainly not imposing sanctions on Russia. So India seems to be trading with Russia, and South Africa didn't go to the recent Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Samoa. They chose to go off to some meeting of the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa.
That
meeting
is an odd pairing indeed, isn't it? Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, it's not good. It's not good having countries aligning themselves with Russia. So I hope that, you know, the pontification from some of those around Trump that China's the only evil empire that matters, and that, you know, we don't care about Russia. That is such a short-sighted statement, and it's just not, they're just not looking at how the Chinese are, you know, have a finger in very many pies, including being friendly with Russia. So, you know, we have to keep, I hope that Trump doesn't pull America out of NATO, and I hope that, you know, if he wins, and I hope that, you know, we do maintain strong relationships. And that they do wake up and smell the Russian coffee, or because I think it might have vodka in it.
Well,
no doubt, probably, yes.
Kamala Harris calling out Trump as a fascist, and that's become a topic now, I think. And Trump's sympathy with Hitler and all those sort of terrible stories. About his relations with his Minister of Defense, Secretary of Defense, and his Chief of Staff, saying that I need generals like Hitler's generals. with their loyalty. And it's really scary the way he's setting his lawyers, his army of lawyers, in the observation posts for the voting booths, which really looks like he's setting to actually steal the election. And so it may be Harris having to go to court to prevent it being stolen, which would be rather ironic.
And however, government limps along in the interim.
There's a very interesting issue. After the last election, Trump put huge pressure on Mike Pence, the vice president, to, in effect, to put a pause in the whole process while Trump could scurry around persuading people to come up with an extra few thousand votes here and there. Because it was, we forget that although in the popular vote term there was a huge, I think it was a 5 million gap in votes between Biden and Trump, but in terms of where a few swing votes might have made a difference, it was extraordinarily close. And it's the role of the vice president to determine whether such a claim is justified or not. So if such a claim were made against, in this case, it would be the current vice president, Kamala Harris, who would have to decide whether a claim against Kamala Harris, the candidate, was successful or not. And
delicious.
I do wonder whether, as far as vested interests go, I'm not saying, it was so crazy from Trump that it would never come up. But as far as vested interests go, you do suspect that might be fairly well up the list.
I'm not sure that's even a vested interest. I think that's a definite conflict of interest.
Okay, yes. Yes, fair point. Yeah. So I think that's what I meant, actually, conflict of interest. Anyway. Just to finish off, this caught my eye. There's a study being done in Australia by a couple of researchers who are looking at this idea that if you put all the world's chimpanzees in a cage with lots of typewriters, they would eventually come up with the complete works of Shakespeare. And these two researchers have taken a look at this as a view and come to the view that even if every chimpanzee in the world was typing nonstop and those chimps were replaced generation by generation, then it would take vastly longer than the lifetime of the universe for them to come up with anything useful.
suppose they were using AI, though.
Well, there's some fabulous stuff in this study, which is it has a serious point, which is that you shouldn't just come up with these ideas, that you have to also look at the constraints of the universe to actually deliver on them. So they've taken an amusing example to make what's quite an interesting point. But apparently, if an individual, there's 200,000 chimps in the world, which I didn't know, an extraordinarily low number.
Endangered species, yeah.
So that was something I didn't know. But if a single chimp types for the rest of its life, there's a 5% chance that it would successfully type the word bananas at some point in the course of that, which is a lovely statistic, I think. And the odds of a chimp in its lifetime producing a sentence, and they give an example, I chimp, therefore I am, the odds of that are 1 in 10 million billion billion. But the study, the conclusion of the study is just magnificent. It says, it is not plausible that even with improved typing speeds or an increase in the chimpanzee population, monkey labor will ever be a viable tool for developing non-trivial written works.
I'm wondering who from the simian community I can invite on to try and defend the corner, but I'll have to go and work on that.
But that, I think, is the best conclusion to a paper I've ever read.
Lovely stuff.
Non-trivial.
Yes, non-trivial written works. If we want those, we should abandon the idea of using chimpanzees to write.
Indeed. Well, with the thought of bananas uppermost, thank you. Have a great weekend. See you next time on the other side.
Cheers, everyone.